up that is strictly KR1 and 2. There's nothing really that much more on the KR1s and 2s, except that we're putting a lot of them out. That's about it. My KR2 now has the turbo supercharged 2100 in it, and I'm using a controllable pitch prop. Flew it in the efficiency contest this morning, but I haven't heard the results. Ran it up, most I would dare is run it up to red line, which is 200 indicated. Took a little over half throttle. So I hope I averaged out almost that. If I did, it'll come out pretty good. Where the thing really shines, of course, is at high altitude. At above 13,000 is where it really comes on. Actually, I like cruising at 13.5 the best. It's nice and cool there for one thing, and I still get the same indicated airspeeds, but it's the ground speed that really comes on. Also, I noticed on fuel consumption, I burn about 50% less fuel at 13.5 than I do at sea level. No, this is I've been flying with a ground adjustable three blade up to about a week ago. This is the first time I've tried a Maluf hydraulic controllable pitch prop. But the speed range of the airplane is so great that it's kind of handy, especially with the bigger engines. Though I haven't noticed any big improvement in performance. It's just that I can go to a much smaller pitch for climb and or for takeoff. Actual cruise is about the same. I know of one KR1 flying with a 2100. And you got to remember, red line is still 200 indicated. And this particular guy told me one day he's running straight and level, and he just ran it up to see what it would do, and he said he got to 235 indicated. See, but according to the flutter analysis, the tail should have broken off right about there. So he says he won't do it again. Yeah, can you hear me all right back there? Yeah, they're shaking their head, yes. Is there any real topics different or anything else that we could touch on this year? Because I don't have anything really new from previous years. And it looks like all of the same people are here from last year and the year before. Yes. Sure, why we use Dynail over fiberglass. Okay. On the test we were running, we needed to get the buckling strength we wanted and get the thin skin to where you don't punch holes in it real easy, we need a skin thickness of roughly 50 thousandths of an inch. And if we went that thick with fiberglass, it added about 60 or 70 pounds to the airplane. See, the Dynail is half the weight for the same thickness. Now, the tensile strength on the fiberglass is much higher, but that was immaterial. Either one of them did fine for this application. That was the main reason. Also, it's much easier to sand and work with, getting around compound curves, someone like that. But either one can be used. I know of KR1s and 2s that have been built using strictly fiberglass. And, of course, I know of one KR2 built entirely out of Kevlar 49. See, Kevlar 49 is half the weight of fiberglass and twice the strength, if you want even more strength than fiberglass. That's the way to go. Of course, the stuff lifts about $14 a yard. Also, that's kind of hard to cut. You can't cut it with anything. Even tin snips won't hack it. So we have found a way. It's using ordinary scissors, but putting masking tape on first, then cutting in the middle of the masking tape. It seems to work, and you have to keep resharpening the scissors. It looks like a brown cloth, but that's what they make bulletproof vests out of. Using 5.5 ounce Kevlar is the only way. If you really want to make it a lot stronger without increasing the weight, that's the way to go. Is there anything else in that one?
Yes.
Oh, on my KR1?
Yeah.
Well, first, I was flying in that television show with it, and they made it up as a target drone, and since all my real antennas are built in, they needed the big dummy antenna on top. They bolted that onto the plexiglass with a big plate underneath it. And it started to vibrate severely. I chopped power, and at 400 feet altitude, it broke through and hit me over the head and knocked me cold. So I didn't see the crash. But the airplane, since it was an idle, slowed to about 50 and then just sank all the way to the ground. The left wing hit a tree, a eucalyptus tree. It sheared a 3-inch diameter eucalyptus tree off. It took out the piece of leading edge, but did not break the spar. Then it swung sideways and went into the ground right wing first. And that wing completely disintegrated. And also it broke the nose off about the middle of the gas tank, 6 inches behind the firewall. The tail broke off right behind me. And then the whole thing swung around and completely disintegrated. Everything that I ran into just broke away. Actually, in the crash, I didn't even get cut, though I was banged up quite a bit. I was pretty sore for about a month. see. But the reason I was hospitalized was because of the concussion that I got when the antenna broke and hit me over the head. I had a concussion from that. But the airplane was completely destroyed. The engine we picked up and found out all that was the matter with it was a ding in the valve cover and a bent exhaust pipe. And so we put it in the other KR-1 that we made into a motor glider. And it's running fine with no modifications. The engine's fine. Matter of fact, we took the radio and most of the instruments out of it and put those in the other airplane. There was no metal parts whatsoever in the whole airplane that were broken, not even a cable. But all the wood and foam was matchsticks. As a matter of fact, it was gusting to 30 knots that day, and most of the smaller pieces of foam just blew away. It just didn't leave hardly any wreckage at all. But no attachment fittings was broken. Yeah, a few of them were bent slightly on one side. No, the spars did not break at the attached fittings. They broke inboard or outboard and splintered up everywhere else. But right at where the attached fittings were bolted on, there was no breaks. So it shows that's not a weak point. And according to some other write-ups other people have been doing for corrections to our planes, adding more metal and all that, it's not required at all. Those are not the weak points on the airplane. That's right. Also, people were worried about our firewall falling off, and it did not break there. It broke 6 inches behind the firewall, about the middle of the gas tank. Well, it was in two pieces. Half it went with the engine, and half went with the fuselage. See, it was right. It broke the whole front off right in the middle of it. So, of course, all the gas just ran out on the desert. Yeah, that particular gas tank had been redone, and to make more room. We had eliminated all the foam and glass right to the sides on both sides. That way it held 11 gallons in a KR-1. The original one only held about 7.5. So we could get 11 gallons in it then. So there was no foam in that particular one, except across the top. Yes? It was per the latest plans, yes. I can't think of any what changes we made to it. Actually, there wasn't that much changes from the original plans. I think we just fiberglassed a little bit on the sides. That was about it. When we put the cheeks on, the cheeks were changed slightly because it was a larger engine. It was an 1834cc Volkswagen at the time. Yes? Right. I forgot what the question was. Mm-hmm. Sure. Right. What was the question again? Right. Okay. Right. The question was that firewall per the latest plans? And the answer was yes. Right. Oh, and the KR-1B, that's the motor glider version of the KR-1. The only modifications we made to that airplane was to add the handle inside for the spoiler flaps. We can still put the little wings back on. It was made so that you could use either set of wings. And it's all built in storage right now. We just ran out of time and haven't had a chance to get back to it, so we've never flown it. We don't know what it'll do. It's just a matter of too many projects going on at once. We've been too busy on the KR-3, and it's just tying us up. I believe it's around 28 feet right now, isn't it? Yes, 28 feet. Sure. With the standard wingspan, it's around 16.5 feet. KR-1 with standard wings has about 12-to-1 glide ratio. Calculates out with the long wings, it's around 24-to-1, which is roughly the same as a Fournier RF-4. Yes, it is a tapered wing. It tapers from 4 feet to 2 feet. At the tips, it's 2 foot cord. On that particular KR-1, the weight in that particular KR-1, you mean? Oh, I'd say 250 pounds, roughly. Yes. No. The outer panels, I believe, is GAW2. See, one of the beauties of foam is whatever the next rib is, it sort of carves into it as you start sanding. So you can change from one airfoil to another as you go. The inboard section still is the REF-48 like it always was. So when you put your little wings back on, you can have the original airfoil. See, but when you put both the other wings on, it tapers into a different airfoil. We wanted a lower speed, higher lift airfoil for that. The red line on the KR-1 with the long wings is 110, 120 right in there, where with the short wings it's 200 indicated. And we've got enough power on it to run it way over red line with the long wings. Actually, with the 1834 in there, I could run 200 indicated at 3,600 RPM with the short wings. I don't know what it'll do with the long wings. We never flew it. The KR-3 has a GW-1 airflow. And that one was chosen for the extreme low-speed characteristics. It's not made to be a high-speed airplane. The KR-3 is probably 100 miles an hour slower than a KR-2 with the same engine. Shall we have a Stu talk on the KR-3? Because he's been running some of the... We've started taxi tests. And as a matter of fact, yesterday afternoon, we took it over to Lake Winnebago and ran it around the lake a little bit just to find out what it would be like to handle in the water. And he's the one that did it. Of course, none of us are seaplane pilots, so we're sort of chicken on what we can do and what we can't, afraid of losing it. Because I know I was afraid to do it. I haven't been in an amphibian yet. We'll find out. Want to take it a while, Stu?
Put up here, up where it belongs. I'm not a seaplane pilot either. I've just talked to everybody that I can on how to do it, and I have talked to some pretty sharp people. We started off the design idea with the intent of just putting it in the water with bare nothing on it, no spray rails, no step vents, no wing floats, and just see what would happen. We looked at other airplanes and saw what they didn't have, and we used everything that everybody didn't have that worked. Like the lake, we didn't see any spray rails on the front of some of them, so we left the spray rails off. And first time we put it in the water, the wing promptly fell over to one side, and every time we added power, we'd go in circles, depending on which wing happened to be in the water at the time. So that was number one. By the way, we're using Don Pedro Lake in California, and those of you who don't live in California may have heard we have a problem out there. The lake is 200 feet low, and by the end of the summer it'll be 250 feet low, and it makes a launching ramp that's about a mile long. So also it's hot down there, so we took it back, and what was it, about 2 weeks later? Yeah, about 2 weeks later. I stuck a set of wing floats on there. We had them all designed how to do it, and we put the floats on and back down to the reservoir, and by that time it had dropped another 10 feet, and it dropped so fast that it leaves a big muddy spot, and we stuck it in the water, and sure enough, we dropped the water rudder down so that it would now be in the water. It was out of the water before. And now it handled pretty nice. We could taxi real slow and about 1,000 RPM and go into the wind sideways and with the wind and drive it up even through the mud. It would come right out and up on the ramp. But let's see what happened. Oh, yeah. We added power, and the nose would drop, of course, I guess like they all do, a little bit, and it would just stay there. And it would just plow more, and the more throttle we gave it, the more wind... waves would come, and just I think it got up to about 7 miles an hour and just pushing all kinds of water. So it was back out on the trailer and back home again. And let's see, we had about 3 weeks to go, two and a half weeks before Oshkosh by then, so it was time enough to put the spray rails on, which were kind of a pain to put on as an afterthought. And then we vented the step. We figured, well, that's going to save one more trial. And painted it, threw it on the trailer, and brought it to Oshkosh. And ever since, for the last 4 or 5 days, I've been getting the questions, well, how does it do off the water? And I go through my long spiel about how everything's been happening and haven't had a chance. Well, we took it over last night, about 3 o'clock, loaded it on the trailer, and took it to your local lake over here, off the end of the runway. And found a neighbor over there with a boat, chase boat, and a paddle, and managed to get it in the water, and it leaked. So we took it out of the water and taped up the the vents for the step because they were done in such a hurry that they vibrated loose on the way out here. And we must have taken on about 2 gallons of water before we got it out. And back in the water again, and it taxied real nice. I found that if we try to taxi too fast, that one wing or the other would, if there was a chop, it would tend to grab that one wing. But I found if I back it off to 1,000 RPM to 1,100, no matter what the chop is, it stays on the wing floats and taxis around just like it did before. Full power, we were real happy that the nose did come up. But that's about all that happened. The nose came up and it went faster. And I know our spray pattern is a lot better than it used to be. The bow wave is now moving back. All we need is more power, because I could only get 2,700 RPM with the way the prop was pitched. We found out another thing, that you need a good covering on the leading edge of a prop, especially a wooden prop. If you'll look at our prop out there, it's chawed up a little on the leading edge. So we're going to try a layer of Kevlar around the leading edge and, of course, repitch it. And I don't think we'll be doing any more testing until we get back to California. If anybody's interested in how the testing is going, I suggest getting with Butch, Ernest, I think your other name is. And he keeps everybody up to date on the newsletter, and everybody will know when and where the plans will be available. If and we'll all we can do is just keep working on it and keep pecking away at it until we can get it up on the step and with two people. That's the big thing. It's a two-place airplane. We do want to haul two people off the water. Chino, oh yeah, that's right, we did try it off the land. I made a plug mold for the cowling, and we have a real sharp guy who pulls the molds off of the plug so that we can produce the fiberglass cowl. Well, the day before I left, we said, well, let's take it out to Chino and see how it does up in ground effect, because we still don't have our final on it. And it does, we use the differential steering on there. The nose wheel is full swiveling. And we were real happy because I could hold the airplane on the center of the center line down either the taxi strip or the runway. It just locked right in. Doesn't want to wander any place. Let's see, on the second taxi run, I went ahead and accelerated, rotated at about 36.7, somewhere in there, and actually got it to lift off a little bit. And if you've ever used the long runway at Chino, it's an old military concrete runway, and it's quite lumpy. And put it back down and promptly busted the nose gear off. If you look under the airplane right now, I didn't even wipe it off. I can wipe it off with gasoline, but I thought I'd just leave it there. And no one's noticed it yet. Yeah. There's a tire skid mark down most of the fuselage. And it went down underneath the fuselage, past the step, down the whole after body, and even into the rudder. And it's just a big skid mark all the way down. And the nose wheel kind of kicked the airplane back up in the air again. And then it just collapsed on the strut and skidded along, didn't even hurt the bottom, just ground the strut away, which I threw away anyway and made a much stronger one, which is the one that's on there now. We shouldn't have any more trouble. So that was our day at Chino, the fire trucks and everything else. I think next time we're going to pick an uncontrolled field, because I brought it back. I knew it was going to happen because I've done it before, and I just sat down in the grass, and here they come with their paperwork. The fire marshal, the tower, the local police, and, you know, I did about $5 worth of damage, and boy, it took me about an hour to get through it. Okay, Ken.
I wonder why they put these things way over your head. So, anyway, that's the extent of all our testing on the KR-3. We would probably have had the okay to fly it by this week if we were home, but we were just so busy trying to get ready for Oshkosh, we just didn't get the FAA in on it just to finish up the final paperwork. We expect to have an okay to fly it as soon as we get back. So that's the status of the KR-3. Is there anything else anybody want to know on any of these? Yes?
Why did you cut the trailing edge
Why did we square up that trailing edge, he says. Well, you'll have to talk to NASA on that. GW1 airfoil has a square trailing edge. That's the shape of it. If you look at the coordinates, it's as square as anything. Is there any other questions? Yes. Okay, I know of one. The question is, how about adding drag for a final approach on the KR-1s and 2s? The KR-1 actually is okay the way it is. With a short wingspan, you can get up a good rate of sink by just slowing down. On the KR-2, it tends to float more because of the higher aspect ratio, and if you're alone, lower wing loading. And there's one KR-2 flying with a dive brake, which means he can actually dive on the runway without building up speed. But on mine, I found that it's not really that necessary. If I make my final approach at 70 or below, it's anywhere between 60 and 70, the visibility is still okay, and the rate of sink is all right, and it won't build up speed. If I try it, also, if I touch down at that speed, there's no float to speak of. At 70, it's starting to. If I come in at 60, I can get the airplane stopped in less than 500 feet. At 70, probably about 800. But if you come in at 80, then you got to figure it's going to take at least 500 to 1,000 feet to bleed it down to where you can get out of ground effect. And if you come in at 100, you need a 10,000-foot runway. Then some, especially if you idle set a little too fast. You can hold 10 miles an hour more on a KR-1 than KR-2 without any more float. I could hold 80 on final with a KR-1 without any problems whatsoever. 80 on a 2, even with two people in, you can figure on 1,000 feet, 80 and above. So I try to just turn final between 70 and 80, and it's a short field airplane then. And of course, everybody knows that they're short field on takeoff, especially with the bigger engines. Several of the KR-1s and 2s out there, they're all set for extreme climb pitch. I notice all of them are in the 2,000 feet a minute rate of climb range or higher. So that's the reason for the low cruise speeds, because they're all run out when they level off. So you just can run the red line, that's it. And probably at half throttle from the sounds of them. 2100 KR-2 should cruise around 180 if you got cruise pitch set in it. These people are talking to Paul Dieter, he says he can run 175 even with climb pitch set on it, but he's got to run up the RPM. He normally cruises around half throttle, he says, but at around 150, 160. Is there anything else? Yes. Well, it's not he asks if, what about weight and balance problems using these bigger engines? Up to 170 pounds on a KR-2, there is no problem. The Turbo 2100 with starter and alternator weighs 170 pounds. I noticed with the metal propeller on, that weighs 15 pounds instead of the 9.5-pound three-blade one I've had up to now, though. For me to fly alone, I sit fairly forward with a big cushion behind me. For me to fly alone for best handling, especially for taxiing, I'm afraid it'll fall on its nose, it's required that I keep my toolbox in the tail. So anytime you see me out there taxiing alone, I've got my toolbox in the airplane. With two people in or a larger person, there's no problem. Maximum weight forward of the firewall, I'd say 185 pounds. Well, 190 including the cowl. See, that's no problem. So I know some people have been talking about putting in the 2500s, but that's 40 pounds more, and so I don't recommend it. And besides that's 100 horsepower, and I don't see any reason for needing that much horsepower. He says he's got a friend building a Mazda engine that weighs less than 150 pounds. Is that a water-cooled Mazda? Well, if that can be done, that's great. The Mazda installations I've seen weigh 300 pounds. Well, if this man can keep his engine into that 150-pound range that he says, that'd work great. Right. I see. Sounds great. That's what we need, is more engines to try, especially a small frontal area one like that, because I was looking for one for a KR-1 to make it look like a P-51 or a P-40.
Well, this one has about a 10-inch diameter, and then
for example,
low, it's on an angle.
In a KR, it sounds like an ideal engine for a KR-1 to make it look like a half-size P-40. The question is extending the motor mount. We actually market both sides, the two motor mounts, one with dual ignition, one without. And there's about an inch and a half difference. It really doesn't matter that much. Most everybody are coming out a little bit heavier because of the finishing anyway, so moving the engine forward an inch and a half doesn't hurt anything. We actually just moved mine forward an inch and a half in the last 2 weeks. We replaced the engine mount so I could put dual ignition on. Mine was converted to dual ignition about 2 weeks ago, which meant I had to go to the longer engine mount or cut a hole in the firewall. The Bendix D2000 is an inch and a half longer than the slick 4016. Well, now I have to fly with my toolbox in the tail. That's what it does to the weight and balance. It's nothing I can't handle or anything. It's just it's only taxing that you need to worry. In the air, it doesn't matter. I'm not forward of the CG in the air, but it makes it really light on the tailwheel for taxing. Question is putting a longer engine mount on a KR-1. If the KR-1 is built exactly per print, it will be nose heavy with a long engine mount. It probably wouldn't even be able to taxi it without it falling on the nose. So if you're going to put on an engine mount that long, we would say move the tail back about 3 inches. Yes. The question is, do we plan on coming out with a long wing version of the KR-2? The answer is no, because it takes too much redesign of the airplane. It looks like the tail's inadequate. It won't handle it. We're on a KR-1 with one person, and the tail is big enough. See, and we don't want to come out with two complete different airplanes. See, we would rather come out with interchangeable wings on the same airplane. So there's no big real big reason to make a motor glider version of the two-seater. It would be a single-seater anyway when you had the long wings on. Up until yesterday, I would have said yes, but I found out yesterday they do not. The engine mount that fits the Revmaster engine lines up with the mounting on a Lycoming O235, and evidently John Monette didn't use those dimensions when he made his castings, because they don't fit. The same Lycoming donuts and all that fit, but the lineup is different. This is the wedge-shaped block under the tailwheel. He says the dimensions varied on the later ones. Well, what happened was I made the block thicker to raise the tail a little bit so I could see over the nose a little better. It has nothing to do with anything else. I was having problems seeing through my spinner, so I made a bigger wedge on the tailwheel and raised the tail a little bit, and that made it easier to see where I was going when I was taxiing. On my KR-2, I taxi with the canopy open most of the time, except at Oshkosh where it's so rough. He asked if anybody's designed a sliding canopy. There are some flying with sliding canopies. I haven't seen any drawings on them. And I saw somebody here yesterday had one, but he didn't bring the airplane with him this year. There was one here last year that had a sliding canopy. We're not advocating it because it adds a lot of weight and complexity. Did anybody ever try an open cockpit on KR-2? I really don't know. I haven't heard of any. I know somebody lost his canopy on in a flight and had to fly at home without it, with no windshield or anything. He said it was kind of wild handling until he got it down 80 miles an hour, and then it was okay, so he just flew all the way home that way. He lost his glasses and everything. See, it was a pure accident. He had just had wood screws holding the hinge on, and he was just coming into a tight turn at high speed, and it just jettisoned, tore right off. He never recovered it either. Yeah, he said it hit the tail and it sliced it in half, but it didn't damage the tail. It's enough to worry about. Yes. Okay, he says, notice some of them had two springs in the tail wheel instead of the one that's called out in the plans. Well, early in the early sets of plans had one spring set out about 5 inches from the end of the block to the hinge point, to the swivel point. And that was too springy. I noticed if you come in and hit tail wheel first, it chewed up the bottom of the rudder every time. So what we did was we shortened it to 3 inches on the later plans, and which works absolutely adequate. But the people that had the earlier plans found out it was too springy, so they added a second spring. We would rather you just shortened it. It's not only lighter, but it works just as good. So, and evidently some of the people with the earlier plans didn't get the word. But shorten it down to 3 inches does it, and in the latest plans it calls it out that way. Yes, is there? Yes, there's one flying with a Continental 65 and one flying with a 75 that I know of. And I just found out about the 65 one yesterday because he was talking to me about it. The one with the Continental 75 was in the last newsletter. It gives a flight report on it. It's a real high rate of climb, but no extra cruise or anything like that. Evidently, they're happy with it, though. On the second flight, they were rolling and looping it, hammerheads, all those things. He's always been doing four-point rolls, too, with it. So evidently, he's not too unhappy with it. But it does raise the frontal area considerably because it's about 6 inches wider and 6 inches longer than the BW engine. So I imagine it would make a funny-looking front end and quite a bit bulgier. I haven't seen it, though, myself. And he didn't send us a picture of it. Yes. Yeah. It depends on which one you order. We sell both. They're both in the price list. Pick up a new price list. We have both. The shorter one lines up with the Volkswagen mounts, and it still works. It even works on a Revmaster. But on the dual ignition ones, the mag hits the firewall. But both of them fit the turbo supercharged engines. Is that from Revmaster? I have no idea. I can't tell. Yeah, right. Or go over and measure my airplane. I got the cowl off it right now. See, that's the way to tell. Otherwise, you'll have to do some sawing and rewelding. Yeah, the shorter mount will fit because it lines up with the Volkswagen mounting holes, and that has to have those or you can't put it on. See, so the shorter one will work with that. That's right. That's right. See, it lines up with those inside holes on that. But and maybe the longer one will line up with the outboard ones. I don't know. It depends on whose dimensions he used when he made the mold for that. If he copied a Lycoming 0235, then it will. So anything else? Way back. Sure you can. See me later. Right. He asked if he could have a latest set of the latest book. Every time we go to reprint, we try to put in all the little comments people've made and pick up all the little problems here and there, clarify points where we've been flooded with questions, things like that, maybe add a picture or two. And we're on the third reprint right now. So his question was, could he get one? Yeah, they are available. Yes. That if you've got a set of the old plans, we'll sell you the new ones and give you full allowance for the old ones. Right. Yeah, right. Matter of fact, I'll do it right here on the field if you catch me outside. Right. It was a question right here. The question is, anybody using shark skin? I believe they're using everything on these airplanes. There's enough of them being built that everything's being used. And I do believe that somebody did make one out of shark skin, but I didn't hear the results. We tried it in our shop, and we couldn't find any advantages or disadvantages. It seemed like it was harder to work with. It wasn't stronger when we got done. So we just didn't bother stocking up with it. If I'm going to go to an exotic material, I'd far rather go to Kevlar. We do have it, but it's not in our price list because it's too expensive. Oh, yes. One of our projects in the shop is trying to pre-mold as much of the airplane as possible We were already selling the forward deck, instrument panel, and gas tank, and cowls. We've made the tooling to do that. Matter of fact, that forward gas tank, it turns out, we've been advertising at 16 gallons, and it looks like they hold closer to 18 gallons. And they already have the indentions for the radio rack, everything molded in. Of course, they can be cut and reglassed in any shape or size anybody would want. We've just completed a mold for pre-molding the entire bottom of the fuselage. That will be molded in Kevlar. And the next step is the turtle deck, molding that. So eventually what we'd like to do is mold an entire airplane, have all the parts where you just glue it together. And one piece by piece, that's what we're doing. We haven't made any of the bottom fuselages yet, but the tooling's complete now. Just haven't had time to work with it. Yes? Actually, we were thinking of pulling one out without making any new tooling by pulling out a KR2 fuselage out of this mold, sawing it right down the middle, and then epoxying it all back together again about 13 inches narrower. Because I've been wanting a new KR1 myself anyway, and that's the way to go. So, but as far as making a new mold, we could pull one off of that, too. But we haven't really decided yet. We're selling about 10 KR2s for every KR1, so it really doesn't make it worthwhile on the KR1s. Yes? There'd be no wood. Right. Matter of fact, when we mold the part, we can set in the firewall plywood already with the shelves and all that already epoxied in, and just set the whole thing in the mold, and it'll come in the fuselage already. Also, we haven't decided if we should put in the vertical spar ahead of time, too, but it makes it a lot harder to ship that way, though. We were considering putting that in, too. It'll all be pre-molded. That'll be the only wood in the fuselage, the firewall and the vertical spar. See, we'll still have wood in the wings and tail and all that, but the whole fuselage will be, the longer runs will be molded in. What they'll be is thicker parts in foam. See, the fuselage is roughly half an inch thick with layers of Kevlar on the outside and inside, and then longer runs molded in of foam with more layers. That's roughly the shape of it. We've also rounded the tail part of it at the bottom. It's not a square cornered anymore on the mold. And one other change is right at the rear of the seat, we widened it about 1 inch, about the shoulder. We haven't decided yet. We haven't pulled any off. We don't know anything about the labor yet involved in getting them, so it's hard to say. It's just one of our projects in the shop. We'll when we get a few of them out, we'll find out. Yes? Yeah, well, right now in the KR3, we would like to start pre-molding parts, but that's still further downstream. Yes, we do intend to, eventually. The KR2 right now is the hot project to pre-mold that. What we're also looking into doing is coming out with a bolt-on kit to make a tricycle gear. I got nothing against tail draggers, really. I've been having a ball with this one, but everybody wants a nose wheel. And there's several KR2s flying right now with nose wheels, and I can't see any big advantage. They're not any easier to handle on the ground or anything like that. So, there's a KR2 at Corona Airport, tricycle retractable gear. It added 60 pounds to the airplane. So, really, it's not worth it for that. What we're trying to do is come up with this one not much heavier than what we got now. So far, we haven't. Not one really satisfactory. Yes. What was one, right? Yeah. When will a molded KR2 be available? Probably in about 6 months, because we have to build one first, check it all out. That's what it'll take, at least that long. We hope to have one. It's going to be called a KR2B. It'd be all molded fuselage and a nose wheel. That's the only difference, mainly. We hope to have one more inch of hip room, too. Yes? Yes, is it lighter in weight? It probably by the time we get done it won't be, but right now it calculates out only about 10 pounds lighter. So, but we haven't finished all the extra beefing we'll need here and there. We'll find spots where we need to add weight. So I figure it'll come out about the same. If it does, we'll have a nice performer, because we're keeping the weight okay. Yes? Oh, what do I think of those heavier wheel castings? I've got no use for them whatsoever. is our latest gear. No one's ever broke one yet. The earlier ones, they have. But any of them we put out in the last year, no one's ever broke one. If they've hit something really solid, it shears off the four mounting bolts, and which is the only part you have to replace, plus plugging up the holes you make, and replacing four bolts, and that's it. So the those heavier, longer gear don't do anything. Also, what they do is they raise the nose so it makes it harder to see where you're going when you're taxiing, which I wouldn't like at all. Mine's high enough. I would like to lower my gear a little bit, matter of fact. But that's about as low as I can go and still have enough prop clearance. And as far as using larger tires on, he's using the same size wheels, but using larger tires on it, we've got quite a few of them flying out of dirt and grass strips and with no problem there. And I've flown mine in and out of dirt and grass strips. Both pretty rough dirt strips, too, some of them. You ought to try landing at Elsinore Airport one of these days. That's a bouncy ride. And when I was flying for that television show, Spencer's Pilots, with my KR-1, we were flying in and out of a strip that all they did was just run a bulldozer across it, straight across the desert for about, 2,000 feet. That was it. It was just a little wider than two scoops. And it was a pretty bouncy ride on that, getting in and out. And then one day, I had to go back to the other airport, and what happened was somebody landed gear up on my airplane, so I had to go back and get a new prop. So they were going to fly me over to Metalark Airport, where I keep it. Had my KR-2 to pull the prop off of it, and we had it. All they had was a Cherokee Lance. So we went barreling down that runway with a Cherokee Lance, and just as we rotated, hit one of the chuck holes and shoved the landing gear right through the left wing and bent the wing up about 30 degrees. It bounced us in the air. I think when we came up on the trees, we couldn't climb over 6 feet. The only thing that saved my life probably was the pilot happened to be Frank Tallman, and he just did a 90-degree bank, went right between two of them and straightened it. Boy, that was enough to make me quit flying right there. Actually, it was the next day that I crashed mine, had my big accident. I was on that set 2 days, and we had five airplane accidents that weren't in the script. So, it was the next day that I quit flying for television. Yes? No, did I get a copy of the filming? I got some of the pictures that we took, but that was all. No, nothing of theirs. Matter of fact, I think they told us later that they didn't take any pictures that day, even though two times they had me hold for 10 minutes in the air while they changed cameras, things like that. But that was a wild ride. Yes? Okay, well, they mentioned something about gear latches. We have found that if you come in on a real rough field, wheel it on, a tail wheel, you come in 3 points, no problem anywhere. You wheel it on, and where you're really going, that the gear works so hard that you can set up some real wild vibrations, and with just one latch spring on each side, you can vibrate those latches up, and it's possible for the gear to retract on you. It's been done several times. We've heard several reports. So on mine, when I found out about that, I just put an extra spring on each side, so I got double latch springs on now. I haven't had any problems. But mainly, I three-point it when I go into a real point, real rough field. Matter of fact, sometimes I even go in tailwheel first. All you have to do is just slow down enough. Don't land over 60 in real rough fields. Well, would I recommend a more complicated interlocking system? I've seen some neat ones where you actually throw it's a bolt with a handle on it in, which locks everything down. And that would be kind of nice. But it's one more operation on gear retraction. So I have nothing against that whatsoever. I think that's great. I just never got around equipment in mine, and I don't have a problem. But I have nothing against that. That, I think, is good. Yes? Is it possible to unlock one side and have one side bounce free? Right. That won't hurt a thing. It might swivel more and be a bouncier ride, but as long as one side's locked and stays locked, the gear won't retract. Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Wicks, Oregon made one landing. They'd forgot the one wasn't locked. It was standing up, but they didn't have any problems landing. They didn't notice until after they got it stopped on their KR-2 landing in Lakeland, Florida one day. So it probably doesn't hurt anything, but having two locks down just makes me feel better. Matter of fact, that's part of my landing checklist, to make sure both of them are down. Well, if the torque bar gets twisted on a hard landing from one being locked and one not locked, it's an easy repair. It's just that you'll have to repair it before you fly it again, that's all, because it'd be in unsafe condition. But if the gear does retract on you in landing, it doesn't do that much damage. We've found that it doesn't even scratch the paint underneath. It still rolls on the tires, and then when you come to a stop, it'll chew up your prop a little bit, and it'll wear out the bottoms of your exhaust pipes. That's all. See, I know of one in Florida that landed gear up, but that was not from the thing unlatching on them. They just left it up, just forgot about it. And he even repaired the prop. It was the wood blade warranty, and the tips were all shattered, and I showed him how to refiberglass the tips, grind them down, rebalance it, and he had the airplane flying again in a week. Say, from a inadvertent gear up landing. Yes. Is there any difference in the vibration on solid motor mount? We don't have a solid motor mount on any of them. Well, the KR1, it's not actually bolted to the firewall. Those are rubber mounts in between. See, so I know my KR1 didn't have any vibration that I knew of, unless I had an extreme out of balance propeller or something like that. No, there essentially is no difference in feel. Not in that line. There's differences in other handling characteristics. The KR1 has a much higher roll rate. That's noticeable. I've talked to somebody that's been flying my KR1 that owns a Pitts on handling, and he says that 80 miles an hour, both of them were about identical in roll rate, everything like that. But he says, but at 180 indicated, the Pitts, the control responses get stiffer as the airspeed goes up. And he says the KR1, there was absolutely no noticeable difference. He could roll just as nice at 180 as 80. Yes, Butch. Oh, okay. Okay, he would like folding wings on a KR2. Originally, we had folding wings on it, but you couldn't trailer it that way because it was just too light loaded, and the wind would blow it. If you tried to tow it on a freeway, anything would blow it over. And we can take the wings off in 15 or 20 minutes, and you ended up taking it off any time you trailered it anyway, so the folding wings didn't buy us anything. They're not that big. Yes. Well, quite a few of them have been spun, roll looped, everything like that. And mine actually has too, but not with me in it. I tend to throw up all over the airplane on the first turn, so I try to avoid that sort of thing. As a matter of fact, I don't even think it's fun. Huh? I've talked to somebody who's done 5-turn spins each way, and he says all it takes to get out of it is just relax the rudders and it'll come out in half a turn on a KR2. So, yes. Yeah, so personally, I couldn't tell you, because I'm not about to. It just ruins my whole day. I can't understand how anybody can do that, that's all. I just get so violently sick, and I'm that way the rest of the day. Yes. Construction time for an experienced builder on a KR2? I've talked to people that build them in between 700 and 800 hours, and most of them are taking 900 to 1,000. That is if they take off all the beer drinking time and the chat time when they got all the friends over, things like that. That's what it's been running. Most of these are a first time project too. Any plans for a wider canopy on the KR2? Really, there's no necessity because we end up cutting quite a bit of it off as it is. On mine, I know I cut off about 4 inches. See, and it's so flexible when you install it that you can set it any width you want. You can even flatten the top and bring the square up the corners. It's all how you mount it. It's plenty big to start with. Matter of fact, I cut off a couple inches off the front also too to get more rake in it. If you notice, my canopy's all busted up right now. That first storm we had Saturday night, the canopy was unlatched evidently, and after I left, and the storm tore it off. It was broken in 4 pieces. re-epoxied it back together just to make it flyable, but it doesn't look very pretty. When I get home, we'll put a new canopy in, and I've been thinking of cutting it, the new one down even further. Get even more rake. Say, this will give me a chance now that I have to replace it. Let's see. Yes. What do you have to do repairs in the rudder elevator? What we do is we just cut holes to pull the bolts out, yes. On the elevator, actually, it isn't removable at all because the rudder post is in the way. We've never had any occasion to remove the elevator. If you ever have to replace it completely, then you could cut a slot. Repairs like that are fairly easy. Where you chop a hole in to get the bolt, get at the bolt like to push a hinge or something like that. All we have to do after is just press in on a block of foam, sand it smooth, re-glass that edge, and then a couple days later grind it real smooth and touch up the paint. We've done that several times, and it's no big deal. I don't think it's any more work than fixing a hole in a fabric airplane. Yes? How did I attach my sling seat? The front part of it is just laid on top of the spar, and a flat piece of aluminum screwed down through the spar right on top of it. Wood screws, yes. It is folded back and sewed with a thin strip of wood in, just forward of that metal strip. The rear side is folded back with an aluminum tubing shoved through, and then U-shaped aluminum strips were bolted through the spar to hold it to it. Pardon? There's three total, one in the center and one on each side. And then on mine, I put that padded fancy upholstery, just laid it right on top, that's all, with some Velcro tape. I found that the sling seat is the most comfortable thing we tried. The ones that build up frame seats and all that, it seems much harder, besides being heavier. And they don't conform to your shape as easy. Anything else we can... Yes? Well, Razorback, I don't know if this is compatible to epoxy. It's for dope and fabric. Dope and so on like that. We're using strictly epoxy, yes? Razorback is fiberglass? It'd probably be adequate then. It'd be harder to sand maybe, but that's about it. Oh, that's right. The pre-coating probably would not be good for it. If you're going to use that, why not just common ordinary fiberglass? About 7-ounce fiberglass would be the ideal. That'd be in the weight range and thickness you'd want. Is there any way we can widen out a KR2? Well, widen out the what? Oh, you would like to widen out our cowl to fit your bird? Well, that's real easy to do. You just cut a slot down the center and re-fiberglass it, and then grind it smooth. All of them, there's some modifications you have to do to fit your engine, prop and everything, combination, spinner, so on like that. So in whiting, it is no worse. That's probably, it sounds like a real simple operation. We've had to add extra bumps on this one. I had one exhaust pipe that stuck out a lot further than the other, so we chopped a hole and re-glassed that. And then later we moved the exhaust pipe so that the bump looks kind of funny all by itself there. But we found out later there was a shorter exhaust pipe there available. We could move it back. But anyway, I'll fix that when I get home. This all came out about a week before I left for Oshkosh, so I didn't have a chance to fix it. Yes? Is it critical where you put your elevator to the rudder post? The ideal is as far back as possible. Of course, if you do it to the per print, the elevator horn actually hits the rudder post. See, because on ours, we had to actually grind a little bit to with a power sander to... give us the 30 degrees up and down elevator. So yes, farther back the better it is. However, you want to have enough elevator control. That's right. Actually, 20 degrees down is adequate, but make sure you got 30 degrees up. I have talked to people that have flown theirs that only had 20 degrees available up, and what it does is to be able to stall it, then you have to use a lot of power and get a really high nose-up attitude, and then it breaks much sharper. You see, with the 30 degrees, you can stall it at much lower speeds and not nearly as much plane with it, and then it breaks much slower. Yes. Yeah. Is there anybody in here that has a flying KR-2 in this audience? You have one? Would you come up and tell about flying it? Give us a little rundown and handling, someone like that. I haven't heard anybody else's talk on one anyway. Find out what it is.
My name is Phil Clauston from Venice, Florida. I have a KR-2 with a Continental A-65, and it's been flying since about the middle of May. And it's been flying since the middle of May. I flew it myself, and I didn't have any difficulty with it. But I let somebody else fly it, and he did. He banged it up for me a little bit. He came in on a wheel landing, and then he got his tail down too quick and hopped up and started to porpoise, and the gear collapsed. So, but for the time I flew it, it handled beautifully. I just shouldn't let anybody else fly it. And the only problem I had was I had to go around to come down, getting off and hop right off the ground, but coming back down, it floats, and you have to get used to that. But it handles very nice in the air. It handles very nice on the ground. I worried about it while I was building it because it's so short. You think it'll be tricky handling on the ground, but it isn't. It's very easy to handle on the ground.
That was a Continental A-65. Someone asked me if they heard of one, and I found one right here, because I hadn't. So, too bad we got someone up here that had one that was banged up, too. That's, I would have thought second thoughts about having them come up then. We weren't supposed to do that. That was uncalled for. Okay, sure, right there. Okay, this is above 13,500 feet. This is, the question was, she says I'm advertising 230 miles per hour. That's what I'm getting, above 13,500 feet at 25 inches manifold pressure and 3,200 RPM. That's maximum continuous power on that engine. I have 25 inches manifold pressure available to 25,000 feet. But I've never been above 20,000 with it. At 20,000 feet, I was climbing 800 feet a minute. And I had 28 inches available. So it's over 5 gallons an hour. It runs between 4.9 and 5.1. Yes. Oh, here's a KR-2 flyer right over there. And there's one. Now let's get him up here. Somebody flew in with a KR-2. Because I've seen pictures of his KR-2 on the wall in my shop. This Dan Deal.
Hi, I'm Dan Deal. I've got the little blue one sitting out there. Flew in from Tulsa yesterday. It took me a little over 5 hours flying time. That's 698 miles from Tulsa Riverside. But my little plane's got about 175, well, it's about 180 hours on it now, I guess. And I painted it once about a month ago to kind of slick it up a little bit just from hangar rash and stuff like that. It's a really a lot of fun little plane to fly. I kind of got after it when I started building it because I'm one that doesn't like to horse around building stuff. I like to get after it so I can play with it. So I built the thing in about 8 months and took off a couple of months here on another project. So I put in probably between 15 and 20 hours a week on it there. So you can kind of figure out your building time on that. And I never had built another airplane before. Also, you find out a lot of little secrets if you... Ernest Cobb's got a real neat little newsletter. Anybody that's building one, I think you ought to subscribe to it because you've got a real neat little deal. And get the back ones. Don't you have them? Yeah, start from one and just buy them all. It doesn't matter what it costs, because you've got a whole lot of little tips there that'll help you, and there's also flight reports and stuff like that. I'm not giving him a pitch here, but I think it's got to get a lot of good little ideas in it. Yeah, I've got more time with somebody than by myself. Every time I get ready to go up, somebody grabs me and wants to go. Mine is 5 1/4 empty, and I have flown with, I weigh about a, okay, I have flown, I weigh about 140, and the heaviest person I've had with me weighs 220, and I think we had a canteen and a couple of knapsacks with us, so figure it out, and it was, I could tell that it was heavy on the tail. Yeah. It's a really good question. My speed coming up here, I checked it several times, was about 152, my ground speed. I had a little bit of a headwind, and I had it throttled back pretty good. I was burning not even quite 4 gallons an hour coming up here, and I flew up here for about $10 worth of gas. I got a 2200cc VW. It's got the big, it's 32mm Posa. I can run, it's got the Bernard Warnke, the ground adjustable prop. I can run wide open about, it'll get almost 3,500 RPM. I've got it set more for climb, I think, than cruise. I can climb out by myself between 1,800 and 2,000 feet a minute, with somebody about 1,400 foot a minute. And it'll hold that to about 6,000 feet. I've had mine almost to 17,000 feet. I've had it to 16,800, I think, and I'm still going up at 350 foot a minute.
What kind of rig are you running?
Oh, 230-pound guy. Yeah, that was, we've got a 4,500-foot runway down there, and I didn't use even a fourth of it. It still gets off pretty quick. Here, as far as your speed, with two people, the weight is not really all that critical, I found. I don't know exactly what the problem. Rate of climb comes down, but as far as top speed, with me by myself with nothing in there and empty of fuel, and you load the thing full of fuel and put a heavy person in there with me, maybe 3 or 4 miles an hour difference. Speed is not real critical on the weight. You do need to change the trim on your adjustable trim tab, though. No problem. This little airplane, I had just got my license. In fact, I started billing before I got my license, and I've been flying a Cessna 150. So you know how they fly. I got in this and got about ready to fly it. And I had 37 people at least wanted to fly it for me. And everybody else kept saying, I think you ought to fly it because you built it. If it's going to get smashed, you ought to do it, you know. So I just kind of thought about it for a long time there. And a friend of mine's got a Globe Swift, and I shot about 2 hours worth of touch and goes in that to get a little tail dragger time. I'd never been in a tail dragger before. And another buddy of mine's got a Luscombe. So I got a hold of a stick. And so I shot about an hour of touch and goes in that. And then crawled in the little KR. And I think my first pass, I got the tail up. And we got a 4,500-foot runway, so we got plenty of room to get it up and chop the throttle and bring it back down and keep from losing it. And then I think on the next pass, I think I lifted it off the ground maybe 2 or 3 feet, and immediately a son of a gun was flying, you know. I got it back down. I wanted to think about this a little bit. And then the next pass, I got it up maybe so far, maybe for 100 feet or maybe even a little bit further, and chopped the throttle. Came down. I was doing wheel landings every time. I was still, you know, 150-minded and wanted to keep where I could see what was going on. It really irritated me. I couldn't see where I was going. Then I got on the next pass. I think I made about 6 or 7 passes. Keep getting it up a little bit higher and wanting to finally time. Just the time before I finally went around a patch, I got it up probably 50 feet, climbed out pretty hard, and then chopped the throttle and came down and landed it. And just so I could see the thing was going to really fly and how it kind of fell. Then I said, finally, this is it. I think I can fly it. And went on around the patch. I went up for about 30 minutes. And after about 10 minutes, I thought, I might as well go ahead and retract the gear. So I retract the gear, went up, did some stalls, get up pretty high. I got up 4,500 feet. You want to do some stalls, get the feel of it, see how it's going to do, maybe do some steep turns. You don't do any stink turns. And keep the G's down. I was just real worried on pulling any G's at all. Anytime I felt anything sag, I thought, oh, the wings are going to rip off, you know. But they don't rip off. I found that out. And so I flew it for probably 30 minutes, 25 or 30 minutes, I think, on the first flight, and the oil temperature was getting a little high. And that was kind of worrying me. It's the busiest airport in Oklahoma down there where I was flying this. We have several hundred movements a day down there. So they had the tower had me over on another frequency on my own, and a bunch of people were on the ground with little portable units and stuff. And everybody's asking me questions. So I, you know, kept pretty well informed and kind of what it looked like from the ground and everything. And really, everything was pretty uneventful until I came in to land, and I couldn't get the gear back down. So you need to remember, retract the gear in the garage before you go to the airport. Don't wait till you fly it to see if it'll retract and everything will go. Because when I could, I kept, well, I retract. Everyone says, how do you retract the gear? You know, you got a lever here and one here, and what do you push down in the middle with? Pretty good trick. So I, by myself, I've gotten to where I can, I just take my right foot off the rudder, reach over there and just pick it up with my toe. Really? No kidding. Pick it up with your toe on the right latch and then grab the left one. Of course, then it just swings. It dangles. Kind of looks like a duck. Then you just take that right foot that you had over here and shove it on down with your foot. No problem. You can't. Is that how you do it, Ken? What else do you do? So anyway, everybody's coming up with all these neat little units where you twist a handle or push a button and it picks them up, and then they think, oh, great, I'll shove it on down. Man, I knocked my head out trying to get to that. I can't reach it on the floor, so I just used my foot. I was afraid that when I popped them both, the wind pushing on the wheels would slam them up through the wing, but they don't. They just kind of dangle, so that's no problem. I don't let the gear down below or over 100 miles an hour. Anyway, I made my latches too tight, to make a long story short. And so when I retracted the gear, I had to shove pretty hard with my foot, and man, it whammied them in there and locked that in good, and I couldn't get it loose. So coming in, I was getting ready to turn, I guess, what do you call it, base there? I'm not a pilot. Anyway, got in there, and I couldn't get the latch loose. So here I was, and the plane was doing one of these numbers, and I was both hands down there jerking on that. And finally, I found if I'd pull real hard and kick on it at the same time to release the tension, I could get it a little bit at a time. Finally, it came, and by then I was kind of looking at the ground up here. Boy, the tower, everybody was screaming, you know. But all turned out well. Came in, everything was fine. I've had basically only one ground loop, and that really wasn't my fault, I don't think.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Sure.
We got time for one more. Go ahead.
How many hours did you have before you made that flight?
How many hours did you have flying time when you made that flight?
Yeah.
Yeah,
probably 50 hours.
Yeah, 50 hours total time, including getting his license. That shows you. We got another question for Dan. Right. Okay, it sounds like he Okay, that answers some of those questions about the spin test. Shows you can even do it by accident. Okay, we've about run out of time. We're over our time. Is there anything else we can get in the last few minutes? Okay, sure. Go back there. Nope. I can't quite make all that out. Oh, yeah, he says his wheels are towed out. Yeah, he said it was by accident. Matter of fact, mine are too. They're a lot more than they should be. You want some tow out, but not much. It's just how you bolt them up there. Should take pains to line them up. Right. That's the whole thing. It wasn't a design problem. I mean, it was just the way you do it. Okay, that's about it. We ran out of time. Right.